How do we start?
Hey, it's Aga and Werner, and this is the Catching the Next Wave podcast, where we discuss the future of design. Today I'm sitting in Denmark with Jerrica Cleland. Jerrica is a person who would not really say much about herself, but she is, by profession, a software engineer who worked at Pixar.
I started as a game engineer and then moved into cinematography.
First of all, you work two offices away from Steve Jobs.
I was, yes.
Yeah. You work on movies like Toy Story 2, Finding Nemo. With Finding Nemo, you went scuba diving research to Hawaii.
Yes.
Oh, I'm so jealous. And Arthur's Christmas.
Yes, Arthur's Christmas. Sony and Aardman.
And then you decided to leave Pixar. Everybody going like, what are you doing?
Why?
Why are you doing this? And decided to become an independent film director.
Yeah, writer, director. Yeah.
And now you are with Norlum in Denmark. Oscar nominated.
Animation studio,
You are doing some awesome stuff here. I've been looking around. We can't really talk about this.
But it's super secret.
Yeah, super secret, but like really awesome. You are also a teacher here in Viborg in
the animation workshop.
You are also giving workshops and lectures, and you consult all around the world.
Masterclasses.
Narrative design and visual narrative design and stuff like that. Pretty cool.
So fun.
So like, we are so lucky to have you here. So like, I would start with my first big question. Why is narrative so important?
As soon as we begin to engage with the world in any way, a human being starts to create narrative. So narrative is fundamental to the way that we perceive our reality, the way we understand ourselves, the way we relate to other people. It's always through narrative. You're carrying with you a story of who you are, what you think, why you think that. Like, we have these narrative spheres that we're always in. I don't think you can separate a human being from story. Mm-hmm. I think it's just an intrinsic part of who we are as soon as we're like sentient and consciously engaging in anything. I also think it's really important because it's the key to our emotions. It's the key to our hearts. And I think when we talk about transformation, like if you're thinking about narrative as a transformative thing, it's the only way we change, actually. The only reason you ever change is that something has shifted your perspective, be it positive or negative experience in life or something that moves you in some way. Narrative is the key to kind of unlocking all of that sort of power of a human being to shift who they are.
Mm-hmm. Many people think that they are not able to create narratives.
There's a really funny thing, like we've built up, at least in our society, this is definitely cultural. Human beings tell stories all the time. And if you look at Aboriginal culture, storytelling is how they teach, how they relate to the world. It's how parents teach children. But we've built up in our culture this idea that only certain people can do it. Or if somebody says, tell me a story, a lot of us freeze. And like, I don't know. I can't think of one. I don't know how. And a lot of my basis for teaching comes from improvisation, because improvisers get up on stage and create stories constantly from suggestions, you know, from the audience in real time without any idea of where it's going. I looked at that from a writing point of view and from a theater point of view, and I was like, that's incredible. What's going on? Because we'll struggle for months, you know, to get a good story. And these guys are doing it, you know, just off the cuff. So I found this sort of study of like how they must be trained. In learning about improv, I realized, oh, everybody can do this. Mm. It is a natural thing for human beings. We just have built up this idea that we can't or we shouldn't, mm-hmm. Or that only certain people are allowed to, or there's a lot of judgment around it. But in fact, it's quite a natural process. It's like breathing. Like, you can't stop your mind, actually, from creating narrative.
Yeah. Hmm. What parts of improv can you transfer to building narratives and storytelling?
That's a great question. I think a lot of people complicate story and storytelling and structure. And it's great that we have, you know, a lot of analysis and heavy research and theory into structure. It's wonderful. But an improviser can't carry around all of that heavy knowledge. So again, I felt like there's something going on there that's very lightweight. And I thought, I like to look for lightweight tools that are like really adaptable. So if you look in any improv training or you read improvisation books, you will find these words. And I also like them because they're very simple and they're very physical and easy to remember. For a story to work, so to speak, for a story to engage us, there's three things that it needs to do. And if it's doing these three things, nothing else really matters. And all that other stuff, like it has to be this, it has to be that, is just simply not true. We need to be able to understand it. Yes, very basic, because if you don't understand it, you get confused and you'll disengage.
Yeah.
We need to feel an emotional connection. because if we don't have an emotional connection, if it's short, it's okay. But for anything that's sustained, if we don't feel, after a while, we're like, this is interesting intellectually, but I'm not really feeling anything, and we disengage. And the third thing is sustained interest. So again, this depends on length. If I'm telling you a joke and it's 30 seconds, you'll like hang with me. But if I'm going to take you through a 90-minute story, it's like, yeah, I have to sustain your interest. Because even if you understand it, and even if you care, after a while, you'll be like, okay, but I'm bored because nothing's happening, and you'll disengage. So basically, if you can keep understanding going, if you can keep an emotional connection alive, and you can sustain interest, it will work. Okay, but there are techniques that you can apply. So in improvisation, the first is the idea of platform. I think of it as like a seesaw that's stable. So like it's on a fulcrum, but mm-hmm. it's a stable mm-hmm. platform
yeah.
at the beginning. The idea is you need to be able to stand on something that's grounding that you can understand. Platform doesn't have to be at the beginning. It can be in the middle of your story. It can be broken into fragments and sort of spread out. But we need to understand who is in the story, who else is in the story, what's going on, and where are they, basically. So you need this idea of, like, what's the foundation? What's the world that we're in, and who are we with? That's your platform. There's a platform for the entire story, but you can also say in each scene, there's like a new mini platform that shows up. So a platform establishes understanding, and it should also establish emotional connection. If you sit in it too long, it gets boring. If it isn't rich enough, we don't understand and we get confused. So it's very easy to tell also if your platform is functioning, because if people are looking confused, yeah, then you're like, okay, I don't have enough information in my platform. One other thing I'll say about that is you need to know your audience to know how to design that platform. Because if it's for children, then the platform needs to be simpler and more clear. If it's for adults, you can do a film like Memento where you drop people in and you piece the platform across the entire film and people put it together. Okay, so platform's the first thing. But a platform just gets really boring after a while. So you don't have the sustained interest piece. So then like a seesaw, you can tilt it, create movement and dynamic by upsetting the platform. We call that a tilt. Tilt is basically any unexpected happening. You can think of it as a reversal. Another word from story structure would be like the gap between expectation and result. Somebody thinks something will happen, something else happens. And if you think of it as a platform, you can tilt it and that will create dynamic movement. So someone will slide off in that direction. Tilts are fundamental to keeping things interesting. If you don't tilt, it's boring and mm-hmm. we disengage. So you have the big tilt at the beginning of the story that we often call the inciting incident, if you're mm-hmm. coming from a writing point of view. But really, you just need tilts all over the place. So you need some bigger, some smaller. When we look at graphs, like intensity graphs, where things go up and things go down, and you have this sort of time like versus intensity, each yeah. one of those points yeah. is a reversal. You can call that a tilt. It's the same thing. So we have platform, then we need to be able to tilt that platform. Then we need something that in improvisation is called causality, which is the relationship between cause and effect. That essentially means if I've built a scenario, say, where I'm an old lady with a cane and something happens to my cane, I should fall. There should be a relationship between the reality and the like what's going on in the scene. So for improvisation, this is essential because you're on stage creating a mimed, pantomime kind of scenario. In writing and in film and probably in experience design as well, that's important, but it's less about that. I would say it's more cohesion. Mm-hmm. So what we're talking about is we set up a world that has certain kind of world rules. Finding Nemo as an example, fish talk underwater. We're like, okay, that's what happens. But if a spaceship showed up, we would be like, what? It would feel like you broke the reality. So cohesion also applies to character. Like we've all felt this, that character would never do that. You know, we feel like a break in cohesion. So I think of causality and cohesion together. And you can think of it as like you've created a world and you need to stay within that space. And we need to do that for character. We need to do that for the world circumstances. So cause and effect, causality is part of that. But I think of it as cohesion. And the idea is if you want someone to stay in fantasy or you want someone to move into a different space, you don't want to break that reality. So we're very careful, especially as filmmakers, visually, sonically, in every way to not break that reality. So we call that cohesion. But this idea of like you are creating a space for people to be in and you don't want to break it. So we have platform, we have tilt, we have cohesion. And then we have this thing called rising stakes. And this is, you know, your classic act two, things get boring. This is because the stakes aren't rising. And what that basically means is there needs to be more risk. We don't just mean empty risk, like you're going to die. No, you're going to die more. No, you're going to even die. You know, it's like after a while, yeah. that's just the same stake, really. Yeah. Action films, like where you get action in quotes, it's often because you're raising the stakes, but you're raising them more physically. And so it feels like it's going up, but it feels empty. We've often had this experience, right, where we're like, oh, it's an action film. And what we mean is it's physicalized and there's danger, but we don't feel emotionally the same kind of risk. But when someone you care about is at risk, or something else is going on with your sense of self or your sense of independence, your agency, you know, there are other things that we can put at risk, then we care a lot more. So we don't necessarily mean that the stakes just need to get bigger physically. We mean that the character has to risk more, if that makes sense. So depending on who your character is, you have to think about what is at risk for that person, what do they value, who else do they value, and then make sure that scenes are increasing the overall risk. So sometimes you might create mortal peril, and that's fine. But there can be other kinds of risk. You can lose a job. You can lose your
family.
Yeah, exactly. You can lose your home. You can lose your integrity. Yeah. Like, integrity is a big one. You know, so it doesn't have to be tangible. And usually when you've got a few of these operating, it's like something personal, something between two people, something within a community. If you can get risk operating in multiple levels, you'd end up with a richer story. So that's something you can think
about. Fascinating.
Yeah. But what you want to do is make sure that the risk is going up. So if you have higher risk and then you go lower risk, people will get bored. They'll disengage because it was more interesting before. So it doesn't always mean bigger. It just means you have to think of it as risk. Because like, I'm going to risk my integrity now. It might be a very quiet scene, but it's very powerful. Because if that's important to me and I'm making this decision, like, am I going to be deceitful here or something like that? It doesn't have to be like an explosion scene. It can be a very quiet scene, but the risk is very high. And that's what we're looking for, is the stakes going up. And then we have the last piece, which is reincorporation. But let me just finish on actually on rising stakes. So rising stakes should drive to some kind of crisis decision. And choice is something a lot of people forget in story. Like, it's very tempting to take your character and push them through the events that you want. Part of what keeps things interesting and part of what helps us connect emotionally is when characters make choices. So you can say that character is revealed by choice under pressure. If you turn a corner and there's a guy with a gun and you run, we're like, okay, everybody would run in that circumstance. But if you turn a corner and someone's threatening somebody with a gun and you make a decision, do I save myself? Do I save that person that's being threatened? Like, how do I engage? Suddenly there's a choice you're making. Do I run and hide for myself, or do I risk myself to save that person? Suddenly we know who you are and we care. The choice that you make in that moment tells us who you are. If you take the heroic action there and like get involved, then we feel one way. If you sneak away and pretend you didn't see anything, we feel another way. But either way, we've made an emotional reaction to that person and we understand that character better. So choice is really important. And a lot of writers will forget how important that is. This moves into design in the same, into experience design in the same way, where it's like if you give choice to people and they have to make decisions, they will be much more emotionally engaged. So choice and stakes are, yeah, are super important. But in the arc of storytelling, we then raise the stakes to some kind of crisis decision. The climax comes as a result of the choice that that character makes. And then we get into resolution. Okay, so that's like classic ending. So the we've talked about platform, tilt,
cohesion,
thank you. You'd think I'd know this. Rising stakes. And the last piece is called reincorporation. This is harder to explain, but we all feel it. So reincorporation is when an element that's been set up earlier in the story comes back again. Uh-huh. So you can think of it as setup and payoff. But it can also be a weakness that caused me trouble in the beginning of the story becomes my strength at the end. Mm-hmm. But the concept of reincorporation, of being able to tie things back in, create meaning by repetition, and then bring that element back, that's very powerful. And the more you do it with things we haven't seen before, like, for example, if we set up in this story that there's this paperclip, like you've given me pages with this paperclip, or we make some kind of meaning out of it between us. And later in the third act, we need to break in somewhere. And we don't have a key. And it's like, but we use the paperclip. Suddenly, everyone's like, oh, the paperclip, you know? Even though it's a mundane object that otherwise has no meaning. We've created meaning for that thing within our story. When it's then reincorporated in a way we don't expect, or it solves a problem, or it's a weapon, or it's given as a token of my devotion to you or something like that, we can take almost any element and create meaning. And then when we reincorporate it, it has a lovely effect of people sort of cheer. They get really excited mm-hmm. when they hear it. So you don't have to have reincorporation. You can tell a story without it, but it's much less satisfying. So we notice its absence, basically. When you see it well done, you'll often have this kind of joyful response to it. You're like, ah, oh, that's awesome. I forgot about that. And look how they wove that back in. That's so cool. So reincorporation is sort of essential in kind of creating a satisfying ending, one that resonates. And for my own taste, I tend to really look for how to create layers of meaning and associate meaning to things that otherwise don't have it. Like if you have something like a gun, there's a heavy weight with it already. So mm-hmm. I would tend to not use that kind of thing mm-hmm. and tend to use something else that I've created meaning by relationship or by repetition. So you create kind of metaphors out of, can be object, it can be a color, it can be any sound, you know, mm-hmm. you can use any element, but when you repeat it and give it meaning and then you reincorporate it in your ending or in a scene climax, it's very powerful. Mm-hmm. So I love stuff like that. So those are the five basic elements of story. I call it substructure because it sits underneath all the structure books you've ever read. And it's why the structure books work. But it's also why, with almost out exception, if you say like, okay, here's a writing book on story structure, you can always come up with an example that it doesn't fit. So this is why those books all work, but it's also why other things work. Like if you look at Shakespeare, he wrote one act plays, four act plays, seven act plays. You do not have to be in a three act structure. Three act structure is great. It's awesome. And it's good to know how it works, but it's not essential. What is essential is that we create understanding, emotional connection, and sustained interest. Mm-hmm. That's what's essential.
Huh. How do you know your audience?
I think there's a lot of instinct involved. There is testing. We definitely do audience testing, but we do it pretty late in the process. So if we're doing a family film, this is why this question always comes up, like who's your audience? Because you do need to know who you're telling a story to. And to be able to figure out how do I tune these elements that we're talking about? How long does the platform need to be? Can I tell the platform at the end? You know, do I have to tell it at the beginning? If it's a children's story, you probably need it somewhere in the beginning because they won't hang with you, you know? But if your target is young adults or your target is adults, you can do a lot more sophisticated stuff. So you really do need to understand your audience. The thing is that we're all audience though. Like as filmmakers, we're often going, okay, I'm making this for someone like me. So you don't need to do a ton of research because like, I know me. or you can ask your friends. Because film is a collaborative medium anyway, generally, especially if you get into anything longer than 5 minutes, pretty much you need a bunch of people to do it. And therefore you have kind of a constant built-in group of people giving opinions. And it's relatively rare sometimes, but at least in my experience, it's relatively rare that you're working on things for which you have no interest. It's less true, I suppose, with crew because they might be like modeling something and they're just really good at modeling, and whether they like the thing they're modeling or not is less mm-hmm. relevant. Mm-hmm. But where I sit as a director, as a writer, in editing or in cinematography, or if I'm working with, you know, an animation director or production designer, tend not to be in those roles if you're not passionate about the material mm-hmm. that you're working on, because you're going to be 3 years in it.
Of course, you know that movies are made
the labor
over
of love.
A long time. But yeah, but
it depends on the medium and it depends on the format. So if you're in an animated feature film, you know, production will be 2 years typically. Pre-production's at least a year, maybe two. And development can be anywhere from 1 to 5 years, 10 years, depending on how long it takes to develop the idea, because it's a really difficult thing. Like how do you put a time frame on developing an idea?
You use this word development. Now being here, I sort of observed what it is. What is it? What is development?
Yeah, what we call development is the sort of ideation process, you could say. It's like from the seed of the idea to being what we call financeable. And this is a very loose, kind of foggy space where there's very little definition on how to do it. Everybody has their own way of coming up with ideas. But we do kind of know what you need to produce at the end to be able to appeal to an investor. So we kind of have an end goal. And the way I think about development, pre-production is similar. It has a little bit more definition around it. But you need to go from, I have this loose idea, to a very specific blueprint, which is your screenplay. So you can think of it as like blueprinting a house. Like you would start with some sketches. You have an idea like, oh, okay, I go to the site. I do some research. You know, I want to design this cool house. This is what it might look like. I do sketches. I look at reference. And then I start doing drawings. Then I'm developing the idea. Maybe I build a model. I talk to a bunch of people. What do you think about solar panels? And what about this? And wouldn't an angled roof look cool? And sharing this house design around to get the mood right, to get the feel right, to get the space right, this kind of thing. And then there's a point where you're like, okay, now I have this blueprint for what I want this thing to look like. I have really detailed drawings. I have some paintings that show it in different times of year or something like that. Maybe I have a model where you can fly through with a camera and see it at nighttime and see it daylight. You know, this might all be material that I've done the development with. Mm-hmm. So for us, it's like story. It's also the look. So the story part is the writing and the, you know, the screenplay. The look development part would be, what medium do we want to work in? Is it computer animation? Is it hand-drawn? Is it a mix? Is it stop motion? Is it live action? You know, is it heavy visual effects? Like, what medium do we want to be in? What's the style? So that's all part of the development, because you can't sell it to somebody unless you can say to them, here are some pictures of what this film will look like, and here's a story you can read, and I can pitch you the concept, and you can see how excited I am about it. And then, you know, we hope to enter a financial relationship where you invest money and we make this film for you and you get your money back. That's kind of the how that works. So development is like a little bit like sculpting. You start with some clay and you're trying to find the form within it. You have a vague idea, but you need to get to something pretty specific out the other end in order to convince people to part with the budget.
Okay, you start with a loose idea, but you do have a goal in mind.
Yeah.
How do you set that goal? I can imagine that there is a collaborative decision there going on.
Yeah. I mean, usually in development, I'm given a lot of free rein. I think my partners are like, we don't know what's going on over there. But at a certain point, I'll come forward and be like, I have this concept. And then I will talk to them about why I think it's valuable for the company. Why I want to make it, why I think we as a studio should be behind it. Or somebody will approach us with an idea and I'll come to them and say, this is why I think this is a great idea. This is a good creator. This is like, I can see it matching into, you know, this business opportunity, this kind of thing. So there is a business case to make. And sometimes it's a totally passion project. And then we know it's going to be small budget or we're going to have to position it very carefully in the market. So we do have a business side for sure. And as early as development, we are considering whether this thing has some validity. Can we actually get it out there? So this is similar to product design. Kind of like, I have this crazy idea for like a cool, I don't know, appliance. But you do have to kind of go like, is anybody going to want to use this thing? You know, so it's similar with this. You're like, if there's stuff that's already like it, that's too similar, okay, that won't work. If it's a very esoteric piece and it's a very, very niche market, then you have to make sure your budget's super tiny. So you can still do it, but you don't want to go for something that's a huge budget and then has a very, very small audience, because you just will lose your money and no one will invest, actually. It's a waste of time. So we do the same kind of case, like, analysis. And then there's a lot of like, do you feel it or don't you? Because it's really hard to develop something if you don't have a passion for it, if you don't feel like you're connecting to it. This is personal. Like, some people, okay, we make the next comedic TV series and, you know, it's this. But most of us are very driven from passion. So you do need that component. And then in terms of like how we map it out, I don't think it's that dissimilar from the design process, of which is you kind of have an instinct for something and you have a shape for it. And you kind of feel like this is how it might match to people who want it. And then you have to go through a series of exercises of development. So be that sketches, research, reference, writing, testing, prototyping, discussing, going back, you know, this kind of thing. But we do know out the other end has to be a package of some kind that we can convince people to part with their money to make it. We're not independently wealthy, so we don't get to just go to our own bank account and be like, okay, here's, you know, $10 million to make this thing. And, you know, film is expensive.
It is.
It is very expensive.
How does the narrative relate to business? Like, is there a place for it in business?
Yeah, there's a huge place for it in business. Going back to this, you asked this question, like, why is story important? And I didn't mean to be flippant. It really is how we operate. So if you are a business positioning, say, a product in the market, and you know who you want to sell to, the question is, what narrative are those people carrying around with them when they encounter your product or when they encounter your advertising or whatever it is? Because you need to understand how they think of themselves, how they relate to whatever that product is. You need to understand that narrative, because that's what's at work for that person. So you need to kind of get the representative narrative. It's like, I'm producing a product for the home, and I know that generally speaking, it's women between 35 and 50 that make those purchasing decisions. Okay, I need to find the representative narrative for that audience. And maybe it's one, maybe it's a couple, but I need to understand, what are they taking with them? You made the example of Apple products the other day. I love this. You're like, Apple made products for designers. So they thought, okay, what does a designer want? Designer wants to look classy. They want to look like they're at the front edge. They want to look sleek. They want people to be impressed by what they're showing, not just what they're showing, but how they're showing it. So if I'm showing you my portfolio and my pages are wrinkled and I've got this old, you know, folder, that's kind of one impression. But if I pull out my iPad and I'm like, here's this beautiful screen with like billions of colors and it's all sleek and gorgeous, my impression, I like how that makes me feel. So my narrative is, in my head, am I going to engage with this product? It's like, does this represent me in the way that I want to show my work? So like, what's the narrative in my head? If you're selling to me, you need to understand that. That's one thing. That's one important piece, is like, what's going on in people's minds already? Then the question is, if there's some distance from your product, how do you create this bridge narrative? How do you move them from the narrative that they're holding in their minds now, the perception that they have, to the one that creates in them the desire for what you want? This is the kind of, I hate to say this, but this is the manipulative part of storytelling. This is where you crack open the heart and you create for somebody a reason, a story that makes them go, oh, this answers something for me. This makes me feel this way, you know, or I can see how my life will be better, like my story will improve when I have this in my life. I have a very strong feeling around business in terms of authenticity. So for me, it's really important if I'm selling something, which I don't do that often, but if I'm selling my phone, for example, that I do it from a place of authenticity. I'm coming at it from this legitimately is this going to make you feel better in these ways, you know, and then I'm creating a narrative for that person that helps them have the opportunity to desire what you want. You don't know why this is better for you. So let me help you understand it from a story point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Let me create a bridge narrative that takes you from where you are now to where you want this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, for example, with the iPod, here's it going back to Apple. Pixar was a very Apple-friendly place. And that you
yeah,
talk about
surprise,
the,
surprise,
yes,
right?
Surprise, surprise. You talk about that curve of like early adopters and stuff like that. Everybody was at the front end of that curve almost. So as soon as something new came out, it went like wildfire through the studio, which made me go, because I'm a rebel, go, I don't want that thing. Like I'm going to resist it just because everybody else has it. So the iPod I remember seeing and being like, ugh, whatever. So I had in my head, this is some sleek new thing that's a big trend and everybody in the studio wants it. And therefore, I won't. This is my narrative. Therefore, I will wait. Even if I think it's kind of cool looking, I'm just going to wait.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was my narrative. So I was resisting. And then I was going to lunch with Lee Unkrich, who just directed Coco. That's how people know him. But at the time, he was co-directing. I think we were on Finding Nemo. And we were going to lunch and I was in his car. And he's one of these early adopters, always has the first of whatever. And he had his iPod in his car. And it was the first time I had seen one physically, like, or been that close to it. And I had this like, can I touch this up? Can I touch it? Yeah. And he's like, yeah, play with it. And I picked it up. And this is the old style one that had the dial that
mechanical
dial. And the moment I had it in my hand and I felt that thing, I was like, I love this.
I want it to stay.
And so for me, it was this kind of like that shifted. Of course, in this case, it was a tangible physical experience, but it shifted my narrative. And then suddenly I was like, okay, I can see why this is amazing. I love music, so it's like why this will make my life better. I now have access to my entire music library at my fingertips, blah, blah, blah. The same narrative everyone else had, but I had to have this bridge narrative. I had to have this reason to go from resisting to desire.
Wanting, yeah.
So we can do this, and story is the way to do it because, mm-hmm. like I said, you only will change when your perspective shifts. Mm-hmm. So something has to create that shift in you. You'll know, you will rarely do something just because someone told you. You will do it because you yourself go through some kind of shift in perspective that makes that thing.
And someone or something enables this shift.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So story is a very powerful way that mm-hmm. we do that. So narrative is really important that way. And then I would say the last piece is like the exit narrative or like once this is more for experience, maybe less for product, but it would be the story of like how you are after you've purchased it. So there's the what's happening in the person's mind when they contact your product, the narrative that takes them to purchasing it or experiencing it. If it's an experience design thing, then it's like, what's the narrative that gets them across the threshold? And then if there's a narrative within the experience, what is that? But we'll set that aside because the other piece that I think is applicable in business throughout is the exit narrative or like, how does this change my life after? What's the story that comes as a result of this thing? And when you make a compelling case on the exit narrative, the whole thing strengthens. We often forget that piece. And this is where you get brands that build loyalty, brands that people come back to, you know, it's because the exit narrative is strong. Like Nike is a really good example where the whole campaign is just do it and it's aspirational. So it's like once you buy our shoes, like you've transformed as a person. So then your next pair of shoes, you're like, yeah, I want one of those.
you go back to it because
the exit narrative is really strong.
Yeah.
Like I get these shoes and then I feel this way. I am this way. It shifts my life in this way. That is a very compelling narrative. Therefore, I will go back to that brand. And it isn't just customer service. It's really the sculpting of that narrative and, mm-hmm. and maintenance of that narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really fundamental to business. And I'd go so far to say is it's also how we should run business. We should think about how we work with other people, how we collaborate. You can think of story as a fundamental part of all of that process as well. So I really think about the narrative of how I design, like development. Okay, we were talking about development earlier. So I've sculpted, like when I go through development with a group of people, as you see me doing now on this feature that we're developing, for me, there's a narrative that I'm creating for that team. and for myself on that journey. It is foggy in the sense that I don't know what we're going to discover, but I am sculpting the narrative of that design. So, and I trust that process, and I trust that my ability to storytell will allow me to navigate this like foggy landscape in a way that will be successful and come clear as I approach it, if that makes sense at all.
Absolutely,
so it's like
yes,
the narrative of the making of it.
Yeah.
So if you were to see this as a documentary later, what's the story? It's that kind of thing of like considering the experience of the people that are doing the thing. How will they talk about it later? Like what is their
memory of it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There is the alternative world, which is the story that's outside of us, but touches us emotionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is the story of the business that brings the product, the service to us. And this is their story that they want to connect with us also on this emotional level. So there is this similarity. Then there is the story that you say to the employees.
That's right.
Which is another layer of narrative design.
Yeah.
And then you've got the story of your own personal life. Some things were helping you and your family to take choices for designing and narrating certain life decisions for you guys.
Definitely.
Could you tell a little bit more about it?
It started from an instinctive place. And the place that I was in was I had finished directing a feature film. I wasn't super happy with my experience on that film. It didn't have the kind of meaning that I wanted. I didn't sort of get the chance to create the product that I thought we could from a potential point. I'm very wired to like maximize potentials. And that's really painful for me because I feel that potential very strongly. And when it doesn't happen, it's really hard. It's like a grieving kind of process, like a death kind of thing. And, you know, it doesn't matter whose fault or whatever. It was just like, oh, we lost this. I mean, I was already out of the studio system. I was already independent, but it pushed me out of kind of that whole industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if it had been less challenging, I might have done a more incremental change. But this created like, okay, I just have to get out. This like there must be a way for me to pursue more meaning and to feel more supported in my like what I need for quality. And like, I don't think business, I come from a very high integrity place. Relationships are really important to me. And I don't think business has to be cutthroat. And I don't think, you know, I feel like there is a way to both be successful.
Way, yeah.
You don't have to stab each other in the back kind of thing. At the same time that I was having this experience of being on this film, I was also teaching here at the animation workshop in Denmark. And two things came very clear. One was consistently seeing a place where this way of being more conscientious, of being more humane, of still being good in business, but like being friendly about it. I was like, yeah, I'm seeing examples of this. I look at Cartoon Saloon.
It was much more balanced.
Much
right?
more balanced. Like I look at Cartoon Saloon's films. They're out of Ireland and they had made Secret of Kells, which was Oscar nominated. And then they made Song of the Sea, which was Oscar nominated. And now they made Breadwinner, which is Oscar nominated. So they have 3 for 3. Keep in mind, there are 5 films per year in animation that are nominated. So
wow.
for an Irish, a small independent studio, completely outside the big studio system to 3 times be able to be at the table with big Disney films, big Pixar films, you know, and I was inside those studios. So I'm looking at like, I know how they make those films. And then I'm seeing these ones that are touching and they're beautiful and they like are very authentic and unique in that way. And I was just like, I want to make stuff like that, you know? So when I think about ejecting from this experience that I had, it's like, I want to be more in this other world. So I could see that as a parallel. And I noticed also when I was teaching here at the animation workshop and people said, what are you working on?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't say I'm directing a feature film, blah, blah, blah. I said, well, I'm working on this side project that's really cool. I'm doing this like horror edgy thing. And I was, you know, but it was like a 3-minute piece, but that's what I talked about. And I was like, why am I not talking about this? So there was something that wasn't ringing true. It's like, okay, what's going on? And then I was reaching this point of like, I'm the breadwinner in our family. So I'm a mother of 3. So there's 5 of us and I carry the weight financially.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that I need to, you know, think about the financial side of things and the bills and the whole 9 yards. And I'm not independently wealthy. Like I work for my, I work for my life. Yeah, exactly. So there is this kind of instant, like, all right, if I need a job, I could go to DreamWorks or I could go to Disney or I could, you know, whatever. And so there is a bit of a safety net knowing that. Every pros and cons list you would write, any conversation I would have to some, you know, with somebody, be like, well, why don't you go to LA and direct a film there or go back to your cinematography and, you know, take a film like that? Like, why don't you do that? That would solve a lot of problems. Yeah, it would. Absolutely. It would solve financially, professionally. You get some kind of like a kudo for that. Wasn't necessarily what I wanted to do. It was interesting, but like could do that. But then I was like, yeah, but what does that say about what I'm creating? And do I feel good about that? Like if I go and work on a sequel of such and such, like, how do I feel about that? And when I thought about it, I'm like, I don't want that. And so what was happening was I was feeling the pressure and like responsibility and, you know, and I was raised to be very responsible. So it's like, I should go do this. But then my gut was like, I don't want to. It was kind of like what was feeling inside. I was like, I don't want to. But I'm also, because as a parent, you will do whatever you need to do for your family. So I was also resisting my resistance. Does mm-hmm. this make sense?
Of course, resisting
the like, of course I'll do what I need to do. Of course I will. So the idea that I didn't want to, I felt bad about that.
Mm-hmm.
And my mind was like, just do this thing. And then my tummy, my heart were like, no, do it. You know. So I was caught in this weird space. And I thought, look, I don't want to begin this conversation from a place of I don't want to. That feels wrong. So I was looking for like, where is this pressure coming from? What is going on in my life that's making me feel that I should do this? And I thought, you know, we haven't reexamined the status quo in a long time. Like usually my husband and I are very good about like checking that things are okay or we make adjustments. Like we're very fluid. So I felt like, oh, we haven't really like checked in on status quo for a while. So what happened basically out of this was maybe I should ask people what makes them happy. Like why, you know, this was the kind of thing that came up. So basically what happened is, long story short, I got some index cards and markers. And I said to the family, okay, I want to try this thing. Everybody take a stack of cards and a marker. And for 20 minutes, I want you to think about what makes you happy, what makes you fulfilled per day, in a week, in a month, year. Like, think about what you need or would like to have in your life. And I wanted them to be specific. Think about people, think about activities, think about places that make you feel good, that make you feel like your life is fulfilling. So we did this. And my youngest was young enough, she was 6, that she was kind of half drawing and half writing. It was super cute. So everybody did this. And then we took our cards and we shared what was important to us, each of us. And so if, say, my daughter was talking about like she wanted, you know, reading time and she wanted to play outside was really important and she wanted to play music, whatever. And if other people in the family felt the same way, you could raise your hand and we made little dots on each card. So mm-hmm. we knew basically all 5 of us care about these things, 4 care about these, 3, 2, 1. Not that one person's thing was any less important, but just as information. Yeah. So we did that. And then we sent the kids to bed. My husband, DJ, and I then spread this stuff out on the floor, like a big matrix of like, what are all the things that all 5 of us like and need? You know, we looked at it and immediately, I mean, not even 30 seconds, the time it took just to take in the cards, it was like, if I go to LA and take a job down there as a director or as a cinematographer, 95% of what's on this matrix goes out the window. 95% of what makes us as a group of 5 people happy doesn't happen. So this is why my gut was like, don't go. But it was so clear. It was so clear because you could see what we were valuing. And you could see that if I wasn't there, if I was living in LA or we as a family moved, that all this stuff would just disappear. And I was like, okay, that just confirmed.
As simple as that, right?
That confirmed. But, you know, any other process, any logical process would yield, go to LA and get a job this way. So that was interesting. It was like, okay, that just invalidated the like logical answer. So I was like, oh, what do you do with that? So we pour some whiskey and we sat there for quite a while and we're like, all right, what if we completely just look at this from a different perspective and say, how do we make 95% of this possible? Like, okay, we won't go for 100%. Like, like how do we make 95% of what's on this matrix possible?
Mm-hmm.
And then we sat with that for a while and you know, really looked at like what was on this list, you know, and it was just stuff you would expect. It was spending time together. It was having creative freedom. It was being able to be in the woods. It was traveling. It was, you know, different things. Financial stability showed up with 2 people caring about it. DJ
you
and me.
DJ. Yeah, of course.
My career showed up with 1 person caring about it. And that's fine, you know, but it was information. So we sat down with that for a while. And then it was really DJ who said, we have to sell the house. I resisted that because I felt like my narrative was it's the house that everyone comes back to. So I had that narrative in my mind. And we had that house. And it was a beautiful house, right? And it was in a great neighborhood and the kids could walk to school. Like we had that whole thing going. And he said, think about it. We had a little cabin on the sea, a really little cabin on the sea. So 74 square meters, 740 square feet for people who know what that means. It's really small. 5 people, it's really small. But, you know, it was on the sea and it was in big nature. And when we looked at like what we valued as a family, suddenly this very different picture emerged. I would never have come to this logically. Mm-hmm. And what emerged from this process of like analyzing what makes us happy, what makes us fulfilled, we sell the home, which means I don't have to take the next project that shows up. It bought me time to allow me to find the right relationships, to develop the right projects, to be able to not feel so tight on timing. Meanwhile, we're living on the ocean. It's small,
yeah,
but it's cozy.
I see the pictures every now and then on Facebook. It's amazing.
That's an amazing place. But when you think about what do we value, he's an artist, I'm a writer, director. Like, we needed this creative space. It gave us time together. We could cook together. We could be in nature. We could play music. We could travel. We can just lock up the cabin and go. And this very different picture emerged. And two of the most important things were looking at what was there and looking at what was not there. And the linchpin in this case, we have three kids. So everyone's first question is like, what about school? And I was like, that's the thing. Learning was on everybody's list. All five of us had learning. Really important. Not one person had school. And I was like,
fascinating.
That is fascinating. 2 days, 3 days later, the kids were like, I forgot to put school. And I was like, you don't get to add 3 days later. It's like in the moment when you thought about what made you happy, school did not show up. And what that said to me was that the social construct and the building and the place of school in this case matters to some people, but in this case was not what they were valuing. They were valuing the learning. They were valuing different kinds of social relationships. So we were like, okay, but if school is not important and learning is important, let's look for options, because suddenly things like distance education come on the table. And so suddenly there was this like, oh, we can live here in this place we absolutely love that supports our creativity and our family time. We can travel abroad to Europe where the kind of work I want to do is supported and I have access into those relationships and opportunities. And then we can be together a lot. We can sort of shed the things that don't work for us, and we can create a life that's really designed around what does work for us. And so it was a pretty radical shift. This is what lifestyle redesign. This is not a solution. Like, this matrix doesn't work for somebody else, but it very authentically came from what we wanted and what we valued. So this is 3.5 years ago. So I can say it's working. Like, we're very five very happy people, you know. We have this sort of weird people look at our lifestyle and like, how does that work? And we're like, you know what? You don't have to understand it.
Yeah, totally.
It really works for us. But it was carefully designed. It's not a random thing. We didn't stumble on it. So I think I use the word what makes you happy. But if I were to coach somebody else, I would say think about what makes you fulfilled and really design from that place. We shifted the narrative. We shifted the whole thing. And what was amazing was, you know, we sat on this, DJ and I, for a while because it was such a radical thing, like sell our house, move out of the city, move to this little tiny cabin, get out of school, like spend half time in Europe.
Like turning your world upside down.
Absolutely. So it was a big thing. And then we just waited until we felt like, we do want to do this. And we presented it to the kids, asked them, what did they think? They were all in. So there was this moment actually on our beach where we all held hands and we're like, okay, we're going to do this thing. 3 weeks later, our house was sold. We moved.
That's big.
I would say within 2 months, we were already like packed, living somewhere else, trying this lifestyle out. Less than 6 months later, we were in Europe for 3 months, you know, moved all around. And the kids, you can imagine, like, their worldview opened way up. And if there's one like thing that's sort of intrinsic in my personality, it's this thing of like, if you tell me you can't, for example, be high integrity and succeed at business, I just don't believe that. And if you tell me I can't be a parent and have a rich family life and have a dynamic, high-powered job, I don't believe that either. Being a woman in the industry, as a cinematographer, there are very few. Directors, very few. Before, as you mentioned, I was a computer engineer, also very few. Yeah. So I've never really felt like I'm not taking that on. Like, you tell me I can't do it. Like, no. You know, I'm going to find a way to do it. And I think this was the most conscious version of that, was this lifestyle redesign. And if you're an experience designer or a product designer, you already know how to do this. Already have, like, when I listen to you talk and the tools that you provide, I'm like, you blow my mind with all the tools and the ways of thinking. It's amazing. And it's like, I don't have those tools. I'm like figuring it out, you know, more instinctively. So I look at those things and go, man, if you could apply that to your own life, you know, or to what you need to shift in your own way of thinking, as well as in your product design, like, it's so powerful. So people in your context already have all the tools to do this.
In Poland, we have the saying that shoemaker is walking without the shoes.
Yeah.
So I think that, like, you know,
of course, that's true.
Yeah, right? In so many ways, the problem with designers that we see how we apply our processes and our tools to the outside world, but we don't really translate them back into our own lives.
But you can. And I would argue that maybe it's a good idea.
Yeah. At least to try it out, right?
Yeah. And to design for fulfillment.
Yeah.
You know, designing for happiness is good, but designing for fulfillment is, I think, better. It's longer term.
What is the place for creatives in today's world?
I think this is a time where creativity and innovation, whatever, however you define that particular word, but that is only opening, that we need to be more creative in our way of working. People look for meaning more. They look for experience more. They look for design more. They want to live life in a way that has a higher quality. We are less about just feeding ourselves. You know, we're more about
and
being
surviving.
Foodies. Of course, there's still plenty of problems to solve in the world. But even those, like look at plastic in the ocean, for example, the kind of creative thinking that's going around that, both on the like scientific level of creating new kinds of plastics, and this is very highly creative thinking, but also in the narrative level. There's this amazing NGO called 4Ocean, I think they're called, and it's two surfers, I think, who mm-hmm. just got sick of seeing plastic in the ocean, and they just decided, like, from a passion place to do something about it. And they are literally out in fleets of boats picking up stuff out of the ocean, like, by hand. Mm-hmm. And they're selling these bracelets to do it. You can check out 4ocean.org, I think, but go buy a bracelet, because each one, it's like a kilogram or a pound, I can't remember now, mm-hmm. but of trash gets taken out of the ocean. So it's a very non-scientific way of doing it, mm-hmm. and it's coming from a place of passion. But the story is so compelling,
yes.
because they are making a difference. As a general population, we need to change. And this kind of creative, more innovative way of working is, that's what's leading the charge. So I actually think it's just opening up more. There's more mm-hmm. need for it on every level.
Your life, like when you were talking about this narrative framework with mm-hmm. the platform and
yes, the tilts
and the fields and everything.
Like rising stakes.
Exactly. Your life stories, it follows this pattern, which also shows like if we probably reflect on our own lives, we can find those elements.
You can. And I think it's interesting that you say that, because I just kind of sparked into an understanding, like an insight into my own life, which is, you know, a lot of people say, like, why did you leave Pixar at this time? Mm-hmm. Or like, why did you decide to have a third child? You know, because that broke convention and these kinds of things. And I've had a couple points in my life where I was comfortable and I could have just stayed there and done that forever. But then I felt like, but I'm not learning and I'm not developing. And so I, like leaving Pixar, I was in a very good situation. I loved it there. It's an amazing studio. And so I needed to, you know, create this tilt, which meant like quitting and just jumping off a cliff and not really having a plan, going out into the indie world that I knew would be less stable and it would be harder to find the kind of creative quality relationships that I had at a place like Pixar. But I don't regret that. Like mm-hmm. it's pushed me into a lot of growth that I otherwise wouldn't have had.
Our big question is like, what is the next big thing? What's next?
I think what's next is a combination of mindfulness, like intention, combined with connectivity. So I think it's that thing of like a lot of people are innovating and being creative in their own spaces. And I think what's going to come soon is this flexibility of thought and speed of connection is going to increase. We're going to find more spaces, like we're going to look at the spaces between things more. Like we spent a lot of time in the last, whatever, 50 to 100 years defining and creating boxes and spaces that people become experts in. And I think a lot of us are frustrated by that and don't want to be in a box. And it's like, it's okay for me to be a filmmaker and a dancer and have an engineering background. And maybe I don't need to hide that. I can't talk about my technical background because people won't perceive me as a creative if I do that. They will devalue my creative ideas because I have a technical background. That's changing now. I think this is going to happen more and more, where skill sets can be multidimensional and quite different, quite eclectic. People will start looking for ways to connect that weren't there before. So we'll see, I think, more fields that are in these crossover spaces. So what happens when you combine engineering, like computer engineering and biology? What happens when you combine space travel and entertainment? What happens when you look at medicine and fashion design? I don't know. But I think we're going to see a lot more of this kind of stuff happening, a lot of boundaries kind of coming down, mm-hmm. people challenging convention, challenging boxes, and sort of more doing like what feels right for them.
If you were to recommend a book, what would it be?
It's weird what came to mind, actually. I'll just say it because this is how we roll in improv, is you just mm-hmm. say what comes to mind. There's a book called Tuesdays with Maury, mm-hmm. and it's written by, I think, Mitch Albom. It's a very small book and it's a very quick read. And the reason it came to mind is that it's so much about relationships and it's about connecting to people in the moment and presence and really spending, like when you're spending time with somebody, being focused on that person and really giving them your full energy and your full like attention. And I think the reason that I say this is that we are so distracted. Our society is so distracted now with devices and there's so many different things going on that we tend to not be very present and not be in the moment. And I think if you want to be good at what you do and you want to relate strongly and you want to succeed in these kinds of things, we have to be able to focus and be present. And that book, in a very kind of narrative way, a very storytelling kind of way, really hit this emotional piece of why it's so important to be, you know, in the moment and with who you're with. That book was very perspective shifting for me. Mm-hmm. So I recommend it.
If you were to say your mission statement, what is it?
To create art that offers people the opportunity to transform, that touches the heart and creates kind of an opportunity mm-hmm. to look at the world in a different way.
Mm-hmm. And if you were to say one advice to everyone listening, what would it be?
Be authentic.
Thank you so very much. It was an amazing conversation. Thank you so very much.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, that was Aga and Werner, and was Catching the Next Wave podcast. And we will be back.